Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline.
Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherell.
Another episode of Offline. You know, it's amazing how long we've been doing this now.
Which is exactly how long?
Which is exactly, I don't know, but we're coming up on 2 years, I would say.
Wow.
We haven't published every single week, but
Wow. This
is episode, I don't know, off the top of my head, 80, 81, something like that.
We have to stop embarrassing ourselves with our lack of knowledge about our own podcast.
I know, what the F?
It has been fun.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And those of you that are worried we're about to say we're shutting it down, that's not what we're about to say.
No. Actually, I feel like we're just kind of hitting our stride now.
Yeah.
So today, Philip, you and I have talked about this challenge that a lot of consultants have, and that is you spend a lot of time, you're very craft focused in many situations, right? Yeah. You're very focused on continually increasing your knowledge about what you do, delivering better and better service, sort of focusing on being the best for each individual client. And the question is that enough to build a business? Can you reliably build a business solely on being the best, or does it take more than that? Now, this, of course, brings up all kinds of things like referability and how conducive your market is to that, mm-hmm. I think is something that gets lost in the discussion about referability. And also, what role should marketing have in all of this, and how important is marketing relatively? So people listening to this, person, well, assuming you're by yourself, hang in there. We don't have a lot of notes about this, but we both have a ton to say. So Philip, tell me, what is your reaction? Is it enough to be the best?
I want to have like some sort of clear opinionated, like, yes, it is, or no, it isn't. But it feels like too nuanced of an issue for that kind of reaction. And so here's what goes through my mind. You ask that question. Could we call it like operational excellence?
Yeah, sure. Or delivery excellence. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that enough to make a business work? And part of me, like, even though I suppose define myself as a marketer, part of me wants that to be true. Part of me wants marketing to be superfluous. Part of me thinks about whoever said the function of marketing is to make sales unnecessary. And right, like the salespeople get pushed into the unnecessary category, right? And part of me says, Alan Rice Weiss is correct when he says, if you don't blow your own horn, there's no music, meaning there's not really going to be a lot of interest in what you do if you're not telling people about it in some way, if you're not out there connecting and building trust. So I have all these mixed reactions, to be honest, which I know is probably not very satisfying for listeners to hear me say, well, you know, it kind of depends, or like I can see it from a bunch of different perspectives. I mean, certainly if we ask the inverse, I would have a clear answer. So to me, the inverse question is, can you get by without operational excellence? And well, I guess there's evidence you can. There's plenty of freelancers out there. There was me at the early part of my career getting by without operational excellence, delivering kind of mediocre or even crappy results. So I guess you can sustain that for a while. And, you know, we all sort of probably know someone who's some flavor of freelancer who kind of just screws it up most times and seems sort of barely competent or not competent, and still doesn't end up homeless somehow. Maybe they have some other sort of offsetting attribute. So I think that's an easier case to talk about, where it really does matter if you can deliver results. That does matter. But I think it's more interesting to treat the question the way you phrased it and to ask, if you just did great work and never did any marketing at all, would that be enough? And I guess what I want to say is, I have seen people go 10, 20, 30 years that way. So I guess in a certain narrow sense, it is.
Yeah. So is it enough is a loaded question, right? So like, what is the threshold? What is enough?
Yeah, right.
And I think what a lot of us are looking at is...
Can I stop you right there? I resisted so hard getting into this because I was afraid you were going to say, well, that's a pedantic discussion or that's just terminology. But you yourself have done it. So we can now dive in together into these waters that I really wanted to dive into, which is like, yeah, what's enough? Or what is a successful business or whatever?
Yep.
Because that's where you're going, right?
Okay, go for it. So let's dive. I mean, you might belly flop on this one, but I want to see you do it.
Okay. Here's one, not metric, but sort of threshold we could set, which is revenue per full-time employee. Perhaps some of the people listening to this have employees, but I'm guessing most don't. And so there's out in like the agency world, which would apply largely to dev shops and boutique consultancies and digital agencies. There's this number around 130 to 150 an hour. And so it's defined an hourly rate, or we could look at it as, I think another common metric is like $130,000 to $150,000 per year in revenue per full-time employee. So that could be one threshold of, if you're not above that, then you're at like a survival level in terms of the economics of your business. So that would be one way to look at it is the economics. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think that is the core of it. So I think what most people will be thinking about when they think about what is enough is the financial return they're getting on their business, because I often feel like the weird one, because I actually had a few panic attacks early on in my business, but I'm pretty zen about it now. Like I'm not that affected, maybe to my detriment, honestly. But financially, you want to do enough to feel like, okay, I'm taking a lot of risk and I'm getting a return that's acceptable given all the other factors. I own my time. I can do what I want. Like I'm building my own thing. And I think also what people will be looking at is the lifestyle factors. So on the far end, you have Gary Vaynerchuk, who says he wants to own the New York Jets. And then you have other people who are like, I only want to work 3 days a week.
Right.
Totally fine. Like that's cool, right? But financially, more than likely, not always, but more than likely, you're not going to do as well as if you worked 5 days a week, because it's a large difference between the two. So I think that those are probably going to be the two things that most people are looking at when they think about what is enough.
Yeah. I mean, to kind of drill down into the economics of it a little bit more, I think a lot of people who might be a self-employed software developer or a self-employed marketing person or a self-employed consultant, you can't just look at it like at 1 year. So you could have a great year as a self-employed consultant and clear, let's say, 300,000. And then you could have a terrible next year, right? And make, I don't know, 80,000. So that's the equivalent of making 160,000 a year, right? If I'm doing my math right on the fly here. You compare that to a job where there's no guarantees, but maybe over that same 2 year period, you would have made 220,000. Well, financially, you're coming out ahead in the job. And I'm not going to get into taxes and self-employment taxes and the higher cost of healthcare if you're self-employed and all that stuff that kind of reduces your earning power somewhat compared to having a job. So David Baker makes this argument that if you're not making, I forget what number specifically he points to, but something in the like the high 200,000s, he's like, you're probably better off just working a job because you'll have a lot less risk. You won't ever, well, no, it's not that you won't ever have to fire somebody. You might be managing people, but you just will have a lot less risk and complexity in your life in the typical job versus being an entrepreneur. So if you're going to be an entrepreneur, his point is you should really do everything you can to make the most of that financially, because you're taking on all that risk and additional stress and so forth. So that's a somewhat persuasive argument to me. I do think there's room for people who are like, well, you know, this is a lifestyle business. I want to work 3 days a week and have a bunch of time with my kids and make a nice sort of solid six-figure, but not much above that salary. I think there's room for that to be okay if that's what an individual person wants.
Okay, there's so many things. I wish David were here right now.
Let me conference him in.
Yeah, seriously. Where's the David button? What is the likelihood that anybody experiences high 200,000s within the first 10 years of their entrepreneurial time? First of all, the stats would bear out. It's very unlikely anybody will make that much ever in a year of their life. So just from purely like averages of the American population or even the world population, very unlikely that anybody will ever make that. So the idea that you'd be able to do that even in the first few years, I would want to ask David, well, like over what time horizon do we need to get to that 200,000, high 200,000 number before he would call it worth it? So I don't know that that's a great metric. Here's what I think personally. I agree, you take on a lot of risk, but if you enjoy being self-employed and you can make in the neighborhood of what you made before, I think it's worth it. To me, it's as simple as that, because now you get the opportunity to, the amount of learning that you do because you have no backstop, to me is like huge. Like I know so much more about myself and who I am and what I'm good at and what I really suck at. And believe me, I suck at a lot of things. I know much more about that now because of this experience. And I think there's tremendous value in that. Of course, Ally Bank doesn't reflect that in my bank account. That takes time. And I think that's kind of the point I'm making, is those things that we learn about ourselves take time to sort of surface in our pay. Now, some people immediately go out solo, and because they're in a niche space that happens to be coming up, bubbling up faster than every other niche within, say, the technology space is the example I'm thinking of. I met a guy here in Portland who's like doing really, really well for himself. He happens to be excellent at what he does, but he also happens to be in a space that's quickly rising to the top in terms of this perfect storm of the technology is desperately needed and there's not enough people to fill those roles. And so the amount that he can charge is really high. But most of us don't experience that, is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I'd like to illustrate that with this totally fictional idea of someone who 2 or 3 years ago finished a data science PhD, and they would have made the decision to start that PhD significantly before there was any like incredible marketplace demand for that skill. Now there's this incredible marketplace demand for that skill. That would have been pure luck. I mean, there's just no better word for that. And they could probably pull in, if in the Bay Area, $400,000 or $500,000 in total compensation, no problem. So that would be a really interesting example. But I bring up David's sort of point of view on that because it is a clearly expressed point of view that he has. Whereas I feel like I don't have such a clear point of view. So I think I was like compensating for not having a clear point of view. But when I think about it, I've got a foot in both camps, but it feels like more weight is on the foot that's in the camp that you just expressed, which is if you want to do business for reasons other than like pure raw financial success, go for it. Because some of us are kind of unemployable because we just would hate the idea of showing up and executing on somebody else's agenda 5 days a week. So I think there's room for people to say, I'm in business for myself and I'm successful by my own metrics. And one of those metrics is I get to do whatever the fuck I want all day long. And I somehow find a way to make money at it. I think that's valid. So I guess where we're landing here is our definition of success or what's enough is going to kind of be up to the person who defines it for themselves.
That's right.
I think what that means is, yeah, I think there's going to be plenty of situations where just doing good work alone is enough.
Well, I think so too. And I think the next point I wanted to make is about your business model. So if your business model is you work with one client at a time for a 6 month stint, and that 6 months can pay for 18 months of your living expenses, the equivalent of 18 months of being employed, I'm pretty sure you can make that work.
I have a client who that describes his situation exactly.
Right. And I think a lot of, especially programmers and coders are in that situation where it's not conducive to doing two or three jobs simultaneously and taking on a bunch of clients all at once. They're probably more looking at having one single client at a time. Yeah. And so I think that's viable. I also think in industries that I've learned this in the last year, because I think I was trying to pick a niche that isn't super well organized or self-identified. But if you're selling to industries that are very well organized, there's like a lot of grease on word of mouth. People talk to each other a lot. Everyone's always on the lookout for next best greatest. Mm-hmm. The chances of you getting referrals in an industry like that are much greater,
yeah.
Right? And so I think if you focus just on operational excellence or delivery excellence, like we were saying, the chances of your referability is much greater than in an industry where it's less tech savvy, it's less organized, there's less like meeting places, and especially if it's like a locally driven thing, I think it can be a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, that's a really great point, is that the context in which you are excellent matters a lot.
A lot. A lot.
Probably more than how excellent you are.
Let me cut you off real quick, yeah. Because I want to get this off my chest. People, this is a pet peeve of mine when people are like, just do the best work and people will refer you. And it's like, yeah, but in what context? Because that's hugely important when it comes to this question. So the idea of being the best is sort of predicated on the notion that people will just refer me and everything will take care of itself. And sometimes yes, and sometimes no. And it just sort of depends on who that original source was. Is that industry? On and on. I apologize for cutting you off.
You amplified what I was saying. I'm going to take us even further afield here and reference this interview I had this morning at 7 a.m. Mountain Time with this guy, Alex, over in the UK. I've been doing some research for a client and got connected with this guy because he's in the telemedicine space. And I wanted to learn more about it. He's a product manager, not a coder. So he thought that he was not a good fit for my request, but I prevailed and we had a 15-minute phone call this morning. He was talking about this service in the UK called Babylon, which is a telemedicine service. So it's like in the UK and then like Zimbabwe or something, some African country. But the thing that was interesting to me that he said was for every one opening that they have for a care provider, a physician, they have 12 applications. So they're building a two-sided market, right? And the demand on the supply side for like, get me into one of these things so that I can provide services without having to be in the office is like super high. It's just a very small, not particularly relevant, but to me, very interesting example of the context and the timing matters a lot. So, you know, you can be excellent, but if you're trying to get into Harvard, you have a lot of competition.
You may even cheat.
Yeah. It's been in the news a lot lately. Or you could be an amazing physician and trying to land a gig on this Babylon service, and you've got a lot of competition. Or you may be excellent in a different context that rewards that excellence much more readily with much less struggle on your part. So that's one of the questions that comes up in the work I do is like, if you have a range of skills you want to specialize and apply them in a certain way, thinking about the context in which your skills could create value is almost more important than the quality of those skills themselves. Like picking the right context is critical. And if you have any flexibility at all about that, pick a context that's going to make things easier for yourself.
Yeah, if you can, right? But going back to the original question, is being the best enough? I think the answer is not always.
Yeah. Or if I can rephrase that a little bit, the same amount of like excellence or operational excellence or whatever could produce vastly different results because of the context, not because of the amount of excellence or the quality of excellence.
That's right. Yeah. I was going to say very disappointingly, not always, but sometimes being the best is enough.
Yeah. A 6 foot tall basket player in middle school is going to dominate. In the NBA, they're going to be like nothing impressive at all unless they have some other skill that doesn't depend on height, right? Because they're going to be playing against people who are 6 foot, what, 6 foot eight and higher?
Well, yeah, I was going to say generally 6 feet will be too short. there are people under 6 feet, but not many.
Yeah, in the NBA. And they're specialists at something else, right? Not being tall.
Not at being tall. We can agree on that for sure.
Right.
Yeah. So in terms of this question of being the best, so what I would look at as factors for yourself is if you're already finding it difficult to acquire clients, you're probably in a competitive market. You may be in a market that's not as well organized, or at least that's saturated. So there's a supply and demand issue there as well. And so I think if you're encountering those forces, my advice to you is being the best clearly is not enough on its own.
So that brings up the question.
What now?
What next?
What now?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Do you add impressive marketing, or do you change the context? Like those might be, those are two of probably multiple options. I guess quitting is certainly another option.
I don't want to make any life decisions for people on this podcast.
Oh, come on. Take a stand, listen.
What I will say is I do believe that most of us in any business you're in, I was just reading an article on The Verge today. Love that website, about how Instagram is now taking over as a key vehicle of word of mouth for a lot of small businesses. And they gave this example of a woman who has a plant business. She buys plants and consults with people about which plants to buy. And of course, the first thing I thought was, that doesn't sound like it pays very well. But there's all kinds of ways to approach it. Now, she's solved her marketing problem with Instagram because she had virtually no traction before. I think all of us will need to have some talent in marketing, and also maybe even more specifically than marketing media. Like, how do I make interesting stuff that people want to consume that also demonstrate my expertise and aptitude? I think that's going to be a requirement. And I do think marketing is an important thing, but I do also want to make a counterpoint because everything is a spectrum. I recently looked up a childhood friend just out of curiosity. What is he up to these days? And I saw him quoted on a very well-known podcast, and he said, marketing is the most important thing. And I think the problem with that is I would completely rephrase it and say, marketing is very important along with these other things, right? Sales and delivery and client service. We can continue to go on down the line, but basically marketing is part of the machine that you need in order for your business to thrive, right? So if word of mouth and referability is not going to do it for you alone, marketing is part of this machine that you need to build. And that to me is inescapable. I like the Alan Weiss quote you had earlier. What was it? If you don't toot your own horn, there's no music.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. That reminds me of something I saw on LinkedIn this morning. Someone was pointing out that they had seen, within some small period of time, a Facebook ad for someone who said they're the world's number one marketing trainer, and another Facebook ad for someone else who said they were the world's number one sales trainer. This person's observation was, I think what everybody at home is thinking, if you're really that good, why would you need to pay for advertising?
I don't agree with that.
Sure. You can understand the sentiment, though, as a sort of hot take of like, if you're really that good, wouldn't the business find you? And so hopefully I've set up something for you to argue against. But again, I think the folks at home can at least understand that sentiment of like, really? If you're that good, like, why do you have an ad in the Yellow Pages or whatever? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, to claim to be number one, I think is just patently absurd, right? Because what does that even mean?
Sure.
You're better than all other sales trainers. You're the most hired. You've created the best sales training. In what industry? Like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah. How would you even measure that?
It's dumb, right? Like, obviously it's dumb. And I thought that's where you're going with it.
But if we set that aside and we assume that they are somewhere in the top 10, they're just amazing. What's your argument for, I know I'm getting on a tangent here, but what's your argument for, hey, it's fine to buy advertising? In other words, it's fine to pay for the ability to connect with people rather than to earn it. I guess that's really what I'm getting at.
Okay, so I think what's coming up here are all of your negative feelings about advertising. So in my opinion, even though they're paying for it, like that person who's trolling them now on LinkedIn, which is a whole other thing that I hate about LinkedIn now, is basically, it didn't work on them. They saw the ad, they didn't interact with the ad, except to publicly shit on them on LinkedIn. Like, great.
They didn't call him out by name, but
you must not have.
Please proceed.
Well, yeah, maybe it was totally hypothetical in that case. But yeah, so my feeling is when you pay for advertising, the advertising still has to be interesting. The actual delivery of what you're doing still has to be interesting. You still have to hook someone's attention. All you're paying for is a faster way to get in front of them. So you're not having to rely on word of mouth. You get to go in front of them. Now, obviously, the most powerful thing you can do is have some virality built into your business where people are telling other people on your behalf. And there's no other form of marketing that will ever do better than powerful virality and word of mouth. It's just not possible.
Should we do an episode on that? Do you have like some examples?
Well, it's just simple math because you're raising your audience to a power every time someone tells someone else.
No, I get that. But like, how do you do that? I think some folks at home would be interested in the answer to that.
Isn't that the $1 trillion question? Yeah. Okay. I'll make a note of that. We should do that at some point.
We may have more questions than answers, but I think it would be an interesting discussion. You're right that I do have some reservations about advertising because mostly it's like the company you keep kind of a argument for me. It's easy to make yourself look bad, I think, with unskillful use of advertising.
I agree with that.
But that's not a blanket criticism of the tool or the medium. It's just, I feel like people like us can make a lot of mistakes with advertising. But that said, it's a really interesting case because I think it's like the clearest case of the question, okay, so if being good is maybe not enough, what do you do? Do you just pay for the scale and the reach that advertising can give you?
Yeah.
Because doesn't that sort of make it look like you don't have anything, any better tools with which to spread the message, like getting invited to speak somewhere or guesting on a podcast or writing really challenging, thought-provoking articles, for example? Like to me, and, you know, I know this has got a lot of assumptions baked into it, but those things seem like they amplify the message that there's some real excellence at play here, where like advertising, it's like, well, there's a budget and that was enough. There was either budget to hire somebody who's good at advertising or there was budget to buy the advertising and you did the creative yourself. You see what I'm getting at?
I see what you're getting at, but I think advertising solves a different problem than you're implying. So the only problem that advertising solves is awareness. You can expose more people to the thing you want them to see today if you pay for it. And so you're basically, which I think what you're conflating is earned awareness with earned long-term attention. So even if I make people aware of my thing, that doesn't solve the problem of having great content that keeps them engaged over a long period of time. I'll give you an example. I acquired my largest training client through a podcast advertisement. So she saw a banner ad. She clicked on the banner ad. She subscribed to my podcast, but then she became a regular listener of my podcast. Only through the power and the value of that content did I make a sale. Right. And even then it took several months of her building trust and credibility and all of that. And so I shortcut the awareness problem that I had by paying for more people to see this advertisement, which again was highly targeted. It was like sales advice for professional consultants and service people. And then when she clicked on that, she started listening, but the content still had to be there. It still had to be good. What I think the kind of cheap, nasty, I'll just name him, Perry Belcher, go look him up. He went to federal prison for misleading people and actually killing them, not murdering them, but basically promising he could cure their cancer. And that was a lie. I think that's what we think of when we think of advertising in this kind of negative light, right? But we could probably look, does the company that spends the most money on advertising also sell the most cars? Probably not. My guess is, I don't even know who sells the most cars right now, but my guess is no.
Well, actually, Tesla is like dominating the luxury category, and they advertise very little because they have someone who's outrageously good at getting organic attention.
By smoking weed with Joe Rogan?
By being like outrageously a bad CEO, but a good sort of hype man. Anyway, I'm so glad I brought this up because you're right. I was taking a sort of more narrow view of advertising. And also, you just gave the perfect example of advertising coupled with demonstrations of expertise over a long enough period of time that that sort of initial like, huh, that's interesting, and someone clicking, transitioning into an escalation of trust and a demonstration of expertise over time. So you're right. I'm a little hard on advertising for sure, but you just brought up the just the perfect counterexample for how it works really well when all the pieces work together. And all the pieces meaning not just the advertising part, but it works as a part of a system.
And the thing is, as hopefully we demonstrated a little bit earlier, is like being the best also is contextual, right? So like referability is very based on your market, how well positioned you are, how much they talk to each other, how organized they are generally, or how communicative they are. So being the best in markets that have less of that, not everyone's going to know that you're the best. They're going to know whoever the incumbent was, or maybe they don't even know your solution exists, right? Maybe they don't even know the categories there. And so what marketing can allow you to do is jumpstart that process of awareness. And so you and I share a deep dislike and even maybe find it abhorrent to see marketing with the purpose of being deceitful or overselling. Like, I'm not advocating for that at all. What I am advocating for, though, is if I have this awesome thing and I think it can help someone out there, why not pay to get it in front of more of those people? Because I believe that they will actually be better off and they'll want it.
Yeah. So I want to invite you into a thought experiment. So you're focused, you're specialized, you have real expertise, you're confident in your expertise. You work with 10 clients. 8 of them say, we've worked with other people like you. You are the best we've ever worked with. So you have this evidence from the marketplace that you're not deluded in your confidence. And you're not happy with the volume of clients that are finding you. Okay, so there's something that the referrals are not happening or whatever. And so you're sort of testing this idea, is being the best enough? And you're finding out, no, it's not. And you have evidence that you are the best, or you're close to the top of the heap. How would you think about what to do next, Liston Witherill? Or what specifically would you do next? I think the second one we can't answer because that depends on contextual factors. But how would you think about what to do next?
In order to grow my business? Is that the goal?
Yes. In order to take your bestness, your greatness, and expose it to more economic opportunity.
Well, so the first and obvious thing you can do is ask for referrals. Go and talk to those people and say, hey, I'm looking to connect with people like fill in the blank. Do you know anybody like that?
Why do you start there? Is it cost? Is it because those turn into leads that tend to close quickly? Why do you start with referrals?
Well, it's because of the transitive principle, right? So the hardest thing to do in all consulting, sales, and marketing is to build trust, because you can make any claim you want. And so the transitive principle says, hey, I trust this person who trusts someone else, therefore I can trust them. I'll take a call with them.
Okay. So it's the sort of trust bootstrapping that makes that your first go-to.
If you will, yes, that's exactly right. So referability, also, if you work with large accounts, expanding those accounts would be another thing you can do. So if you work with Fortune, even 5,000 companies, they're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of employees each. And so chances are you're not fully serving that account in the maximum way that you could. So that would be the next thing I would look at. And the reason I focus on those two things is like, you have everything you need to do that. It's just a matter of having a conversation and then patience and diligence in your follow-up. Then the next thing I would look at, is like, okay, once you exhaust your existing network, what do you do next? And that's when I start to look at content marketing. And I love content because, first of all, and I'm sure you would attest to this, it's painfully slow to make it and to get it in front of people. But when people do respond it, they're already respond to it, they're already sold on you. So I love creating useful content assets because it also gives me an excuse to follow up with anybody in the future. Hey, I made something new. I thought about you. Would you like to see it? And then only then would I consider advertising. I was talking to someone this morning who's built her agency. The source of all of her new pipeline is from an outsourced lead generation company, which was surprising. She said that working with this guy, his name's Mark, has been transformative, she said. And I said, why is that? She goes, well, Mark has two things that he tells all of his clients they need in order to do well. And this is a free endorsement for Philip Morgan. And I said, what are those two things? And she said, positioning and creating content. And I was like, yep, I agree with that. And so I do think that that's kind of next. And so if you're already creating some content and you have a way of distributing it, continue to do that. But advertising is another way to distribute your content. Here's the thing. There's no such thing as free distribution. There's no such thing as free anything. But you're saying, well, I don't want to pay for advertising because it means I couldn't earn it, right? But how have you built an email list?
Largely through guesting on podcasts. Not entirely, but largely.
Okay. So that took time. That took effort to reach out. That was not free, right? And it was also built on the strength of partially, at least maybe in the last year or two, the reputation that you've built.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it fits under the earned exposure umbrella.
How many of those podcasts did you initiate, though?
What do you mean?
Didn't you contacted people in to some percentage and said, I'm a great guest for your podcast. Would you have me?
Yeah, some. But actually, if I look back at the, 30 or 40 podcasts I've been on, some of them sought me out, probably more than half.
Yeah.
Or I knew the host and we're friends and I'm like, hey, do you need a guest? Which is almost as good as them reaching out to me. It was just a sort of trivial thing to get on the podcast.
So I'm not saying that being a guest on the podcast is the same as advertising, but what I am saying is there's no such thing as free anything. So there's earned and there's paid.
Sure.
Right. But both of them are going to require an investment of some sort. To me, the biggest downside of paid is that people didn't choose it. They're being bombarded with it. And also, there's no long-term reuse. Every additional view of that content you have to pay for. Whereas if it's organic or earned, you get compounding returns on it. In theory, not always, but in theory.
I was going to say that's a good place to wrap up, but I think we could just touch it briefly on like the next remedy or the other remedy to you are some variation of the best or you're really good, right? And it's not enough. And that gets back to the situation of the context in which you're the best is very competitive or just not a good match for some reason. And you could be the best in a different context. And you, this is not like a snide, snarky thing, but you have more experience shifting the context that you play in than I do. Because I think you could say, I just got lucky. Or, I mean, I'm not going to bullshit anybody and say I was just amazingly full of foresight. But I chose a market that has been fairly receptive to my efforts at being really good and really helpful to them. You have more experience with like, that market just doesn't seem to vibe with what I'm offering. So let me pick a different market. So can you speak to that a little bit? Like that's the next remedy or maybe the last remedy is instead of adding marketing, you're just like, I'm going to go to a different sandbox to play where it's more fun and more profitable and the revenue is easier to find.
Yeah. I don't have a perfect answer for this. I know Jonathan and Rochelle just recorded a podcast on this, I guess maybe a few weeks or months back by the time this gets published. So we can link to that show because we certainly it's more than I can cover in a few minutes. But I think the main thing, like in my sales training business that I've been thinking about recently is like essentially like who's already buying this? And then based on that, what are sort of the blue oceans within that marketplace? So I think that that's one question that I'm asking. I also think it would be difficult to enter a market where you have zero credibility. Like that's when you really need to start looking at, could I do some free work or heavily discounted work? Because you need a case study and a few examples to show that you're competent at least. And also very few people want to be first. And so twisting that first person's arm is a difficult thing. So yeah, I would think about that stuff. For me recently, what I've thought is, hey, this is what I've done is very good. And I've gotten great feedback about it, right? But it just doesn't feel like, you know, I have so little of that virality that we discussed earlier that it feels like there's a problem, either with my positioning or with the market or both. And so I think making small, subtle changes, but also I've been lucky enough to attract enough people to say, hey, this looks like it is validated. If I changed directions here, I would just now need to change my outward positioning. But essentially, like, it seems like I'm getting enough traction and this is going to be a repeatable problem whereby I can go try it. Now, my next step is to go ask people, is this something you would be open to discussing?
Yeah. And really, you've sort of walked listeners through the process of what this change is. There's risk. It is a change. It's moving away from what you know, which might be a shitty situation that you know, but it's the devil you know. I'm not saying your situation is a shitty one, Liston, but some folks are in exactly that kind of shitty situation. But it's what you know, and that feels less risky, actually, than making the change, even though the change might be, if there was some way to measure it exactly, it might be less risk than just doing what you're doing. So it feels risky, and you gather evidence, you think about it, and you try to take as much risk out of it as you can. And then you start talking to people, you start trying to have conversations. So you've sort of walked folks through what the process is. I mean, it looks pretty much the same for everybody, unless you skip a step, in which case you're not de-risking it as much as you could.
Right. Which is scary.
Maybe that's a good place to leave things for those who are thinking about excellence and whether it's enough.
I think so.
Sometimes it is. If you're lucky, I think it is enough. But sometimes you have to add extra things like marketing or making a courageous change in where the context in which you show up and try to create value.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thanks, Philip.
Good talking to you, my man.